Good evening, listeners, brave navigators of the enigmatic and the concealed. Have you ever felt the pull of the unanswered, the allure of the mysteries that shroud our existence? For more than a decade, a unique comic publisher has dared to dive into these mysteries, unafraid of the secrets they might uncover. This audacious entity is Paranoid American. Welcome to the mystifying universe of the Paranoid American podcast.
Launched in the year 2012, Paranoid American has been on a mission to decipher the encrypted secrets of our world. From the unnerving enigma of MKUltra mind control to the clandestine assemblies of secret societies. From the awe-inspiring frontiers of forbidden technology to the arcane patterns of occult symbols in our very own pop culture. They have committed to unveiling the concealed realities that lie just beneath the surface. Join us as we navigate these intricate landscapes, decoding the hidden scripts of our society and challenging the accepted perceptions of reality.
Folks, I've got a big problem on my hands. There's a company called Paranoid American making all these funny memes and comics. Now, I'm a fair guy. I believe in free speech, as long as it doesn't cross the line. And if these AI-generated memes dare to make fun of me, they're crossing the line.
This is your expedition into the realm of the extraordinary, the secret, the shrouded. Come with us as we sift through the world's grand mysteries, question the standardized narratives, and brave the cryptic labyrinth of the concealed truth. So strap yourselves in, broaden your horizons, and steel yourselves for a voyage into the enigmatic heart of the Paranoid American podcast, where each story, every image, every revelation brings us one step closer to the elusive truth.
All right, today we've got a super long overdue guest, Adam from Deborah Gets Red Pilled. I know Adam since I think one of my first podcasts ever that you guys had me on. So I wanted to thank you for that, first of all. And just how the hell are you doing, bud?
I'm doing well, man. I woke up a little bit under the weather today, so my voice is a little gravelly. I might cough a little bit, but yeah. That was awesome getting you on way back in the day. That was super early. I'm not really doing my show anymore, but that was early on in our show. And I can't remember how I found you, but somehow came across your Instagram. And it was when you were just like posting cool, obscure books. And then you started showing the comic book stuff. And I reached out and got you.
It was back when I had like one or two titles to my name, I think. So I had a bunch of others in the works, but I didn't want to share anything. And so I came out of my shell since then, but you were, played a huge part in that. And I guess so did Deborah by extension. And so you said you're not really doing the show as much. Anyway, I saw you had a few released this year, but I just wanted to get a recap for anyone that wants to go back and listen to like your backlog, which is like one of the coolest concepts ever for any podcast, in my opinion. But it's called Deborah Gets Red Pilled, and it's essentially you trying to convince your mother-in-law to like leave her current political views or like adopt new ones, or like just give me like the rundown of what the original concept was.
Yeah, the original concept was just it just came out of me kind of waking up around the 2016 elections, and then just kind of developing a relationship with my mother-in-law, and she's a super awesome lady. And I was, you know, I'm closer to her than my real mom, and I would just troll her relentlessly. She is from Marin County, California, which is the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge, really wealthy county in California. A lot of, you know, the financial execs and stuff from that work in San Francisco live there. And, you know, she would be called, you know, they're not like, you know, millionaire wealthy, but they're upper middle class. And she'd be called, you know, coastal leftist elite, you know, and just had, would just repeat CNN talking points and things like that. And it was just fun to, I would, at the time I was, I considered myself an anarcho-capitalist, which is just as cringy, but,
I mean, equally, but I wouldn't say they're like the same. You know what I mean?
Yeah, different, but just as gay.
Separate but equal.
Yeah. And I would just troll her relentlessly. And then, you know, I was getting into, I was figuring out about economics and things like that. And I'd been a leftist shitlib before that too. I just wasn't really awake to anything. I had a bad drinking problem for a long time. I got sober in 2012, you know, around 2015, I was starting to wake up, but I was living in the Bay Area too. And I was still a product of that, you know, that, mind virus that's there. So yeah, I'm curious
where that mind virus come from. That, like, in your opinion, did it come from school? Did it come from culture? Did it come from just the rest of the city having the mind virus?
Yeah, it's just if you're living, I lived in Oakland and San Francisco, and if you're there, it's really, really isolating if you have any sort of conservative or right wing views, and if you don't, it's, you're never going to get exposed to those. So I had always kind of been, you know, a little bit more right wing naturally, just because I was a working class guy who always went out and did construction and realized how bad it sucked to have to, like, pay for everybody else. But then at the same time, I was, you know, a what we would call in as just being a caught up in the spirit of the age. And so, you know, just the craziness that started around that election, and having a little bit of Trump derangement syndrome at first. And then I was a big Bernie guy. And what really flipped the script for me was when he was in the primaries against Hillary Clinton, and they were doing the he would go to a state and he would win the primary, but they would have these super delegates, is what they'd call them. And they were like these super votes that came from like one person. So even though he would win the popular vote in the state, like these people who were all members of the DNC had these super delegate positions, and they would just push Hillary Clinton over the top. And I was just like, this seems real fishy.
Blessed be her name.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she's a fantastic lady. You know, I was a union member at the time, and, you know, Bernie bent the knee, kissed the ring, said we should vote for her. My union told me to vote for her. I did it. You know, like, that's how far I've come. I voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, you know? So,
all right, we're done here. I didn't know about that. I'm sorry, audience. I didn't know that going into this. I feel blindsided.
Yeah. So I've come a long way since then. And yeah, I was just getting into, I heard Dave Smith on Joe Rogan early on, and was like, wow, this guy's, you know, speaking my language. And I was a fan of people, you know, taking responsibility for themselves and trying to kind of figure it out and make their own way. And that's kind of what libertarianism sounded like to me at the time. I wasn't aware of all the shady backroom dealings and the history of, like, how the party was conceived and who was in the living room when they did it. But it was the Koch brothers. And but
the modern day libertarian party was conceived under the guise of the Koch brothers.
Yeah. In the set in like 1970 in some living room with the Koch brothers. Yeah. And now they have a gay race communist as their presidential candidate. So,
yeah. What's his name? Chase Bliss. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's actually a name of a really good car pedal company. I didn't mean to say that.
It sounds like a gay porn star. Chase Oliver, I think, is the guy's name.
Chase Oliver.
Yeah.
No shit. Chase Bliss. Send me a free pedal, please. Consider this promo.
Yeah, but so I was like, you know, when you figure out like something new and it's like your big new toy and you want to like share it with everybody. I was kind of that annoying guy. And I was doing it with Deborah, and I was also listening to a lot of I got into like conspiracy podcast. So
this is libertarianism that you were excited about?
Yeah, I was super excited about like Austrian economics and libertarianism. And then I was also excited about like a lot of the more weird esoteric conspiracy stuff. So I was sharing it with Deborah and just freaking her out and catching her. And she wasn't being, you know, philosophically consistent, which is a big thing that when you first become in that mindset, you think like, oh, if I can just show these people that they're philosophically being inconsistent, and then maybe they'll read Anatomy of the State by Murray Rothbard. Oh, it'll change the world. And, you know, I don't think, you know, and so it came from all that. We were having these big long conversations. I was just sending her DMs and funny Instagram posts and things like that to try to get her. And then I was like, you know, all these, conspiracy podcasts are fun. I like them, but a lot of times just a couple people in a room or, agreeing with each other. And I was like, what if I could just bring on some of the weirdest people in the world? And, or, you know, I think originally I had planned to just do all the research myself and present a case tour every week, a conspiracy tour every week. And then a couple weeks in, I was like, I don't want to do all this research. So I started reaching out.
A lot of work, man.
Yeah. I started reaching out and getting guests and taking her along for the ride. And we had some really good shows, some really bad, boring shows, you know, the whole run. We went for, you know, 210 episodes, something like that. And, in the meantime, I left libertarianism. I converted to Orthodox Christianity. We left the city. I live on a farm now. I quit my, you know, extremely good paying with benefits union job, and I just homestead full time now. So it's come a long way. I learned a lot of lessons from it. I'm a different guy. So as much fun and not fun as the podcast was, I think it really helped me get to where I am in my life right now.
So, I mean, you said Orthodox Christian, but it doesn't sound like Orthodox Christian is incompatible or mutually exclusive with libertarianism. So where you land politically at this point?
I think I'm like pretty far right wing. I don't know.
How far? How are we talking funny mustache far?
I'm to the point where I'm like, you know, I'm not what people think funny mustache man was, but I'm willing to look into that whole thing and think that maybe it's not the real story. That's
what helpful. About, what's your concept of libertarianism? Did it change out from under you at any point, or was it just always, something that you got caught up in and then realized later on? Like,
what it was always fake and gay.
Yeah.
I don't think it changed at all. I think it's just, you know, if you classical liberalism will always get us to where we are right now.
It's not even that there's bad actors running it and like self-neutering it. Like philosophically, is libertarianism?
I think the purpose of it is to get us to here. I think you can, if you follow it down the line far enough, you just get right back to where we are.
So I mean, the next step in the current political sphere, if things just keep going the way they're going and just naturally extrapolate that, it does seem, not an alarmist way, but like not a full-on civil war, but it almost seems that the sides have been getting emboldened with more and more people jumping off of the sort of like little niche Green Party and libertarianism and sort of either jumping on full board to like the two party or just completely abandoning the system altogether. But if either way, both of those seem to be steering towards these like two monolithic parties, and even the like the pretend little side green parties and third parties, those are almost silly, right? Like I would almost assume that like the newer generations have to see that they're never really the viable option. Like it's either you play with the system and pick one of the big two, or you abandon the system altogether. But I don't know. Yeah. Neither of those sound like they're tenable.
I think when you have a third party who's, you know, that's already split in half between, you know, gay race communists and people that are spurg, you know, autistic dudes that are super into Austrian economics. And then you elect Chase Oliver as your presidential candidate. I think that that's an op that is designed to push people towards the orange guy.
What's it going to take to get you to vote for Donald in this upcoming election?
I'll vote for him. I mean, I'm not. I'm okay.
So as opposed to abandoning the battlefield, like just pile on.
And I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to go out and stump for the guy or think that it's going to change anything. But I'm not going to. You know, I'm not a everything's an op guy. But I think that there's nudges and pushes from everywhere, and I don't think any of us are smart enough to know the whole story. But I think
it's pragmatic, man. I don't disagree with you because I'm not immune from any of this. I think my options are exactly the same. It's either like abandon the system or in my case, become like a one issue voter. As stupid as that seems, like at least that's the one thing that I can pretend might have something going for, even though I don't even believe that the candidate that stands for a specific issue would ever actually stand for that issue of pushing.
Yeah, it's tough because like
as capital.
as my flavor of Christianity, like a one, you know, if we were at abortion on the table as our one issue, I don't have a choice of anyone, you know.
Without if you basically could select, I mean, this is a hypothetical, right? This is not in reality. But let's just say that you had the choice to pick of all the candidates. You had like the last vote that was going to break the tie out of all these, you know, candidates that were running, and they were all on single issues. Would abortion truly be above any other single issue that you could think of?
I think so, yeah.
And why is that in particular?
I think it's the most horrific sin that a human can commit. I think it's a sin worse than murder.
Well, explain that, because I mean, murder is, I always considered it to be murder, no matter what age, and that's not in like a judgmental way, but I kind of feel like let's at least call a spade and then work from there. Like it doesn't, like my opinion, I mean, Roman Catholic, so I kind of have like a bias going into this, and I'm definitely, I guess I would say I'm more pro-choice, but not in like a militant way, in that I think that it should go on your record of like what your body count is. Like you should actually have like receipts somewhere in your permanent record that's like, here's how many people that you've murdered, just so that it's like taken a little bit more seriously and not just like, oh, you know, the clump of cells kind of argument. I absolutely understand the more militant approach of like, don't condone it, don't acknowledge it, don't allow it to happen, because it's like, if you say worse than murder.
Yeah, the problem with having it on as a, you know, on your resume is that, you know, where I live, it would be a positive thing on a resume. It would be, you know, to apply at Starbucks, you'd need four of them.
I mean, I'm not going to argue against it, man. I feel that naturally people on all extremes, because there's absolutely examples of people that go out of their way to do it and flaunt it and make like a big deal out of it as if it were making some kind of a social statement, which is really weird to me. Like, I don't know if they're going to like be burdened for, you know, in hell for eternity and like regretting that, or if it's like something that gets forgiven because God in his infinite wisdom and works in mysterious ways.
I don't want to get into a big theological debate on here because I'm not a theologian, but it's, you know, you can come back from it in my religion. You know, you have to confess repent.
I mean, even in my understanding, at least, of Catholicism, is that you can pretty much always come back from it. I mean, that's why it's like famous with the mafiosos, right? They're like, yo, I can do what, and I can still get in. So that's always been one aspect. And I know that that's a little bit of a fallacy, because you have to actually change and accept God into your heart. Like, there's prerequisites to it. You don't just get to like wake up and be like, oh, my bad. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got a blank slate. But
the difference is, for us, there's no guaranteed salvation for anybody.
Oh, explain that to me. You're talking about Orthodox Christianity?
Yeah. We don't guarantee salvation. You have to live a life of repentance and prayer and fasting. And you know, if you do that well, hopefully you make it.
Is there a judgment process through St. Peter, or is that outside of Orthodox?
I don't know what the deal is with that whole part. Like I said, I'm not a theologian. We have a weird thing called the toll booths that some people agree with and some don't. In Orthodoxy, and it's like you go along this path and you revisit all the sins of your past and how you dealt with them and things like that. So yeah, I mean, it's just it's not that, doesn't it seem strange to you to be, just be able to say like, oh, I believe in Christ, I'm saved, I'm going to heaven, and then you can do whatever you want for the rest of your life? Is
seems pretty sweet, bro. Seems like the ultimate game genie, like cheat code.
Yeah, so we don't have that. it's a lifelong body of work and suffering. So,
are there any unforgivable sins at all? Because I mean, one of the ones that's really abstract that I've learned about was like denial of the Holy Spirit or blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. I think that might be like a Catholic specific thing.
Yeah, I know we have like denial of the Trinity or worshiping with, you know, other other religions or at another temple, but I'm not quite sure if there's any like mortal sins that you can't come back from. I don't believe so.
The toll booth that you were just describing, is that in the afterlife you go back and revisit like all the bad things that you've done?
Yeah, it's like a pathway along the way. We don't have like purgatory. So there's a modern priest named Father Seraphim Rose, who's from San Francisco, and then lived in a monastery in Northern California in Platina. And he wrote a book called The Soul After Death, and it deals with that whole process, if anybody's interested. And he also wrote some really great books on the UFO deception and things like that. So
there's two other religions or denominations that remind me of this a little bit. And neither of us are theologians. So like one of my examples is Jack Chick from the old Chick Tracks. And yeah. I think the very first Chick Track, the first big one, at least, and I don't mean like format big, that he had big, the one that got popular was called This Is Your Life, I believe. And the whole concept.
Yeah, I've got that one. A guy that came and did work on my house gave it to me after I told him that Orthodoxy didn't guarantee salvation. He got super mad at me. And then the next day he came back and gave me that track.
I mean, but okay. So Jack Chick had his own flavor. I don't even know if you could pin it down as any particular denomination other than like Jack T. Chick Christianity. But the whole premise of that pamphlet is that when you die, you have to go into like this big movie theater with like God on your right and, you know, Gabriel on your left or Saint Peter on your left. And you got to like sit there and rewatch every bad thing that you've ever done. Like with an audience, you know, with the
on the silver audience. Screen. Is it you playing yourself or is there actors portraying you?
I always thought it was like recorded, like, you know, it was okay. like the Star Trek.
It'd be way cooler if it was like either a full on actor, like biopic with like a cool actor like Brad Pitt or Bradley Cooper. Or maybe
that's actually their like, hell is that they have to go up to heaven and just play other people's crappy lives over and over.
Yeah, yeah. Or you could do like an ID Network like reenactment, really crappy like reenactment version of it.
I mean, the premise though I find to be really fascinating, and also because California based, but like some of the OG Rosicrucian books that I've read that came out of California. They describe this process of that when you die, you don't necessarily sit down in a movie theater with God, Jack G. Chick style, but you do relive all of your previous experiences, good and bad, but you do it in reverse. So like if you live to be 90 and you die, then you have to like relive 89 and then 88 and 87 all the way back until you get to the very beginning. But the thing is that like if you've done a lot of horrible things in your life, you have to go back and like relive all of those with the knowledge of the 90-year-old. So like every bad thing that you did is like a little shit 5-year-old, like you're doing that and you're reliving it with the context and the scope of your whole life. So it feels like extra bad, even for the stuff that you thought you did with. So I always thought that was interesting because it's also a Rosicrucian practice. And I don't know if this is like black magic or what. I think it's more like hypnosis. But at the end of every day, as you lay down before you go to sleep, you're supposed to relive that day in reverse. So you think about what you did right before you got into bed. What did you do right before you were starting to get sleepy? And you go all the way back until like, you know, waking up in that morning.
What if you fall asleep first?
Well, then you screwed up. And then you got to try it again the next day because the whole premise of doing that is that you're training yourself for when you do die and you have to relive your life backwards. You already kind of like know how to process things in reverse order. So you can take what would normally, you know, be another 80 years until you can get back to normal, and you can like cut that in half or you can cut it into a quarter. So now it only takes 20 years to go back through your entire life. And that I don't know what the purpose of that is. I just always thought that was an interesting concept that's based on top of this, like reliving your life with God next to you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know as much about the toll booths as I should to be speaking about it. But yeah, I know that that's there. But I also know that it is debated in the Orthodox world as well.
Are there any things that are not debated? Is there anything that everyone agrees on, like wholeheartedly within Orthodox?
Um, I don't know. I don't. I mean,
because to me, Orthodox sounds almost monolithic. Like Orthodox means that you follow things to the T. But how could anyone ever agree on what those things are when it comes to Christianity?
And we don't have like the Pope. You know, that's the difference. That was the schiz. That's when.
So if there was a debate within your church that you go to, and there was a disagreement on like how to interpret something, who would you go to? Just the pastor or the father of that church?
I think it would, you know, revert back to all the councils and apostolic succession and all that stuff. It's not like a Protestant church where you can kind of like where each priest is, or each pastor, if you go to like a different Baptist church, is going to have a different interpretation. So,
well, I mean, my Catholic upbringing only allows me to understand this in the scope of a regular hierarchy. So it's usually you've got your preachers and you've got your bishops and your cardinals, and all the way up at the top of is the Pope. And it's almost like a Supreme Court president situation where if there's ever a disagreement on whether something is canon or not canon, or sinful or not sinful, or whatever. You know?
Instead of the Pope, we would have Christ at the very top. So we don't
But who's talking to Christ to get his opinion?
We don't have the I guess it would go to, you know, we have the hierarchy, but if people are misbehaving and interpreting things the incorrect way, it can be remedied that way.
It's slippery slope territory, right? Because it's like, who's
but you guys think that the Pope is, you guys think that the Pope is infallible.
Well, Roman Catholics do. I don't identify as Roman Catholic anymore. I think that's kind of silly that a human being could be infallible. But
exactly.
I appreciate the role that the Pope plays. My view of Roman Catholicism is definitely heretical. It would not get me in anyone's good graces in the Roman Catholic Church. But it's almost like the Pope represents the entire legal system, or like in the U.S. Right? We've got, when we first started out, we had like the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And then over time, now we've got stacks upon stacks where you could spend your entire life reading all the laws we've passed over the last 200 years, and you still wouldn't get through them all. The Pope is kind of like the guy that represents all the laws that have ever been written about Christianity. So if anything ever comes up, he's like the ultimate lawyer that's like, oh, we've got legal precedent. Let me go back into my book. So see here in this case in 1200, you know, there was this papal bull, this decree that settled this. The science is settled on this. So like, that's done. Here's the answer. We've got it all figured out. And the Roman Catholic Church, as I understand it, is just the amalgamation of every one of those like Supreme Court decisions that happened within Catholicism. So that if anyone ever has an idea, it's never a new idea. If you ever come up with a heresy, they've already got it documented. It's like the ultimate DSM / I don't even know any other equivalent. But like there, it's the original corporate charter and all the corporate bylaws. I think like that's kind of what the Roman Catholic Church, and in a way it serves an interesting role, because if you are into theology, now you've got like the ultimate legal sort of like cases to go back and look through and see like, what did the thinkers already determine on this 1,000 years ago?
Yeah. But then you have like Vatican II in the 60s that the Pope now supports. So if the Pope's infallible and he supports Vatican II, then if you don't,
you're actually schism with the Pope. Well, I think Mormonism's more appealing than Roman Catholicism, just because it's on a faster track. Like the Roman Catholic Church has all of these tendrils, and it's very slow because it's so old and it's so like antiquated and legacy, and they have to deal with all these different denominations that they have kind of created. Whereas Mormonism, they've streamlined it to where you almost expect every year, every 4 years, or every like a half dozen years that they kind of say, oh, by the way, here's the new interpretations. We got this wrong and this wrong. We've changed this and we've dotted this I over here. So it's like already in this constant dynamic flux where it doesn't seem like, oh my God, they're pulled the rope out from under us. Oh my God, the Pope went from this to this. In Mormonism, it's almost like you expect a little bit of that stuff to come down and surprise you, which makes them more nimble, I guess. Am I selling you at all on becoming a Mormon?
No, I don't think so.
So, I mean, how do you know deep down that you've settled on like Orthodox Christianity and like this was the thing that you've been waiting on, or do you not know that?
I mean, I'm not going to say I came to it the right way. I came to it through lockdowns and pandemic and living in a horrible place and seeing like the most evil things going on around me nonstop. Realizing that, you know, years and years of atheism since being, you know, being a Roman Catholic I was confirmed Roman Catholic and that was the last time I ever went to church. And, you know, I was in my 40s and just feeling like there's something missing.
When was the last time you were at church before then? Are we talking like 13 or are we talking like
30? I got confirmed when I was 17.
Okay.
And I didn't have to drink
the blood and eat the body and all that.
I took first communion when I was like 10.
Okay. Okay.
I actually did go to midnight mass at the Vatican 1 year just cause I was in Italy over Christmas. And I did take communion there, but that was when I was like 22 or 21, 22. And then nothing, atheism for 20 years, you know, dosed up with a healthy, unhealthy dose of a new age AA stuff, getting tricked into, you know, a lot of just this weird Bay Area, you know, crystal meditation stuff.
What was the weirdest thing that you believed at that point in your life?
I wasn't a believer of anything, but I just was susceptible to go to do anything, you know, like people would, you know, people are reaching for things and are missing. They have what they say in AA, you have like a God-sized hole that you're trying to fill. And, you know, I would go to like meditation retreats or like think that, you know, Reiki healing might work or any, you know, just insert all the Bay Area bullshit. And I was into, you know, in a whole handful of it. So, but yeah, then fast forward, you know, we move up to Oregon. We're living outside of Portland. I just see just the most disgusting evil shit going on for, you know, 3 years. I know that I want to, I start feeling some weird Christian stuff. I know that, I want to go check it out. And I know I didn't have any Protestant experience, which is strange for a lot of Americans to comprehend. I knew kind of a little bit about Sola Scriptura, and that sounds super goofy to me. I knew I didn't want to be Roman Catholic because, you know, everything that the Roman Catholic Church is famous for over the last 50 years was happening around me at Catholic school. And, you know, the next thing that I kind of investigated was Orthodoxy. And I knew a little bit about it when I lived in Oakland. There's a big, gigantic Greek Orthodox church up on the hill. And I just, I thought they were like Catholics, but maybe a little stricter. A lot of people in the post-libertarian sphere started talking about it. Vin Armani started, you know, making a pretty compelling case for it. And I was listening to him a little bit. And, I did a podcast with my friend Buck Johnson, who was in the process of converting. And, he knew some guys in Portland that were attending Eastern Orthodox church here. It gave my number to one of them. One of them called me. I went to my first liturgy on Pentecost, so almost 2 years ago, and felt the presence of Christ as soon as I walked into our church. And that's the first time that it ever happened to me in my life. And that's it. I'm what they would say is heart, not head. You know, I didn't feel the need to like read every theological book or create a philosophy around it. It was what I felt inside. So
you said your original impression was like a more strict version of Roman Catholicism. How close to that were you, and what would you describe it as now?
How close was I to?
So you said your original impression of Orthodoxy was that it was maybe like Catholicism, but stricter maybe.
My understanding of Catholic Mass and like having been through, you know, liturgical services before made it so I could kind of follow along with what was going on, although it's extremely different in a Russian Orthodox church. You can kind of know what's going on a little bit if you've been to Catholic Mass. I know that there's extremely different theological differences. I don't know how much stricter or anything like that is. I think we have, you know, there's slight variances in rules and, you know, things on like birth control and divorce and things like that. But to me, it wasn't really about all that stuff. And I'm not Jay Dyer. I'm not trying to prove anybody wrong, or I don't have the knowledge or intelligence or background to do it. But to me, it was just feel. And, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that's going to go and shame people for what kind of Christian church they're attending. We don't judge anybody else's salvation, is what the priest told us in our first day of catechism. And that sounded good to me. We're not an evangelical church, but it is my job to just, I don't want to say entice people, but to just live a good life. And, you know, hopefully people will recognize that and attraction rather than promotion, and become curious about it and talk to me about it. And maybe I can convert some people.
The word evangelical there is a really interesting one. Just because, like, as you say that, and you even kind of like mentioned this, that as you found Greek Orthodoxy or Christian Orthodoxy,
Russian, and, Eastern,
Eastern. What's the difference between Greek and Russian Orthodoxy? Is there a big difference?
I think there's some definite cultural differences. I can't really talk that much about it. I've never been to Greek Orthodox service. I know there's some definite differences between the liturgies. I know a big one. It's like we don't have pews. We stand. But I think they might be a little bit more loosey-goosey, kind of like Catholics, you know?
Well, you mentioned you found Russian Orthodoxy. And if anything, you almost like stop being as prevalent in podcasting and like making this, you know, like the social presence as a priority. You moved out of the city, you're like homesteading now. The point that I'm making is that it's not like you found a new religion and then you immediately started like, and sign up for my Patreon, and here's my new book about the religion I found, and here's my t-shirt that says, you know, like Orthodoxy is, there seems to be, from the outside looking in, that Christ is like hot right now, and not hot in that like everyone's getting attracted and converting, but that it's almost like financially a smart move to like go all in on Christ and be very vocal about it and like create podcasts and products and whole like themes and brands around going like hard in the paint. And I'm just, do you think there's a lot of Christian grifters? Do you think they're easy to point out?
I think there's a lot of Christian grifters. And I think that it's also one of those things that I talked about early on, like with libertarianism, is like people get a new toy and they're so excited about it. You know, people that are converts or catechumens or inquirers are going on Twitter. Like Orthodox Twitter is just gross. And it's all these people that should not be speaking on things who are like, you know, telling people like, oh, you need to read this book, and they, you know, like this, that, like, just
here's my affiliate code, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, not even that as much. It's just people that are like trying to come off as authorities who have no business doing it, you know? And, it's bad. And, I think there's some people who are doing it for the grift. I think there's some people that are doing it just because they're so into it. And it's just, you need to, like, if you're going to do that, you're supposed to like go talk to your priest. You're supposed to talk to your spiritual father and like talk to him about it. Like, if you're not an experienced in the theology of that religion, you know, you shouldn't be coming off as an authority to people. And if you're not, beholden to somebody above you that can correct you, you know? So there's a lot of that going on. And yeah, I think there definitely is a lot of people grifting, and it just, it puts the, puts it in a bad light to a lot of people. It may attract some people, but it also, pushes a lot of people away, and it's just, it's bad, you know?
I don't even know if anyone's targeting specifically the Orthodox religion, but you mentioned Orthodox Twitter. Like, what's Orthodox Twitter all about? Like, what are the kind of things that you're seeing?
It's people telling people that they're doing it wrong.
Oh,
that shouldn't be telling anybody anything. People that should be going to catechumen class and like catechism and learning from someone else, listening and not telling people what to do. You ever get like sucked down? I don't know if you ever do, but you get into one little subgenre and it becomes your whole world and you like a couple accounts. And the next thing you know, it's like all that's on your timeline. And sometimes, you know, there's the trad cat version of it and all that stuff. And like
the trad, what?
Trad cat, traditional Catholic, okay. Latin mass Catholics, you know, stuff like that. And it's all there. And, you know, get like red pill, like the manosphere and stuff kind of has overlaps with all this stuff. And just,
so you have to claim, what's the manosphere?
Manosphere is, you know, like Rollo Tomasi, like books like his, it's just like the man's rights movement. You ever?
Oh, like give me my foreskin back kind of thing. And like,
no, it's MRA, MRA? No, it's like talking, that's like asking girls what their body count is and telling chicks that like if they're 30 and don't have kids yet, they don't have any eggs and that they're washed up. And, you know,
I didn't know there was a name. I mean, I noticed that that's like a new genre that's really hot on Twitter now.
It comes out of like the, you know, the pickup scene kind of do you remember the game?
Yeah,
I don't remember the game, but I know about the game.
Neil Strauss, right?
Yeah, and then like there's this guy Rollo Tomasi. It's like telling guys to get vasectomies, don't get tied down, sleep with as many women as you can, travel perpetually, read voraciously, go swimming. You know, like you could do all this stuff if you don't allow you don't get traditionally married and things like that.
That was an interesting movement, man, because like, and it was like the pickup artist or like the PUA movement. There was game, there was like a VH1 reality show, like all those dudes got like really big for a small moment in time. But
yeah,
that stuff exploded right as I was discovering NLP, and really pickup art was really someone just read NLP for marketing and self-help and was like, I can use this.
What's NLP?
NLP is neuro-linguistic programming.
It's
basically the backbone for what pickup artists built on top of. And when you're talking about like the trad cat, like, you know, what's your body count, slut, like that kind of talk.
Yeah, that's like in negging. Orthodoxy. That's in Orthodoxy as well too, I think. So a lot of, you know, does that NLP stuff, can we do a hard segue into Aquino? Is that like kind of his stuff?
So my definition of NLP, which might not be the perfect one, but it's more like some people are born charismatic, right? Like Jim Jones, for example, of People's Temple. Mm-hmm. There were stories that even when he was like 7, he was like going out and getting all the kids in the neighborhood and like preaching to them. Like he was born with charisma. And there's other people.
Yeah, he's doing animal funerals.
Yeah, exactly. But like, even as weird as that was, apparently he made people feel very comfortable and like kept coming to him because he just exuded rapport. Like he knew how to develop rapport instinctually. I don't think someone sat him down as a 7-year-old and like, here's how you're going to manipulate people's feelings. And here's how you pay attention to like body language. And here's how you respond to it. I don't think that happened. Possible. Maybe he was trained from the CIA as a baby, but if we just assume that
maybe Dan Mitrione was visiting him when he was in his cradle.
Well, but like some people, even that I've met personally that you would never even know, but like some people are just born with charisma. Like they are charismatic people that exist outside of like training for it. It's like an inherent thing, but it's also a learned skill. So NLP is basically people with no charisma, people that have no rapport, that just consider themselves like outside that bubble, sat down and just analyzed people that had the skills, and they write down like every single trait, and then they eventually come up with a list of patterns, and it's like, oh wow. What was it? Andrew Carnegie, I think it was like 7 habits of highly successful people, or how to make friends and make everyone like you. I know I'm butchering the names of these, but this is exactly the same concept.
Influence people and make friends, or something right.
And,
like
and
that.
One of those is make sure that you always remember their name. Make sure you say their name when you meet somebody, like at least 3 times. Like there's all these like little shortcuts, and this is where the NLP and the pickup artist and the ethics line maybe is under like debate sometimes. But I think that there shouldn't be any difference at all that if you had to read it in a book or you had to go to training and someone had to say, remember people's names, say it 3 times the first time you meet them, and that will develop rapport. And like consciously doing that versus Jim Jones is just like charismatic from birth, and he just inherently knows to do all those things without being told it. So that's my impression of NLP, is that it was just like a list of, here's the things that highly successful socially people do to build rapport with other people, and here's how you can apply it, and here's how you can test it and stuff. That was the original concept of NLP. So when you bring up Michael Aquino, I think that people use NLP because it helps you build rapport, but then they can use those things for whatever purpose they want. So if you go into a room and you know that you could be the most popular guy in there, if you shake everyone's hand, you say everyone's name 3 times and no one else is doing that, now all of a sudden you almost stand out as like a leader, because everyone's like, oh yeah, did you meet that Michael guy? Oh yeah, he remembered my name. Oh, I got a really good vibe from him. And if you can get a whole room of people that are like built rapport with you, now you can form a cult and go and take over whatever small city that you want.
Yeah. And it takes a special kind of person that has born with that and then wants to do that as well. Because I don't want to talk to anybody. You know,
well, but you could also be the one that just wants to do it, doesn't know how to do it, and then you discover NLP, and now, and that's kind of the best example of like pickup artists, right? Where like a lot of pickup artists were what you would describe, I guess, modern as like an incel, like the involuntarily celibate, and didn't know what that, like, what am I doing wrong? And then some pickup artist was like, here's some NLP techniques, but now instead of building rapport with people around you for business deals, or instead of doing it for your own self, like, here's how you can destroy other people's rapport. Here's how you can chip them down and by proxy, like, lift yourself up over it, which is that whole negging concept where you're supposed to walk into a room, and if someone greets you and they smile, you're like, oh, you got something in your teeth, you know, like, just like a like a little thing, just so that you throw them off their game, and now they're not so confident. And if you can do that subtly enough, that's kind of what the original, and that I would consider that like the black hat version, like, of NLP,
like hitting on the fat girl instead of her super hot friend.
Well, I mean, kind of, but that would actually, you're showing higher worth to the people around without doing anything like inherently bad or negative or destroying, but like the teeth thing, or like just giving people, like, a weird one is hot cold stuff, like in knowingly love bombing someone,
yeah,
and then giving them the cold shoulder and then love bombing them again and just repeating that process. Like, if you know that you're doing it in order to manipulate someone's emotional state, like, that's on the verge of black hat, like unethical, you're kind of a scumbag.
Yeah, that's Charles Manson stuff.
On the ugly chick.
Okay.
It's the same. It's a similar premise, though, because the whole concept is you're just building rapport. Like, if it were a video game, you're just trying to improve your points. And once your points get so high, then just like any girl wants to bang you. That's kind of the premise of being a pickup artist. In NLP, it's like, if you get the points high enough, they'll buy that car, or they'll buy that freaking whatever the hell tchotchke you're trying to sell them. That's like the salesman version of it. But then there's also the self-defense version of it, where now if you understand NLP and all those tactics and you're in front of Michael Aquino and he's trying to like sell you on his cult religion, you could be like, oh, this dude is one of my favorite one is called spatial anchoring. And that's where if I'm talking to you, imagine I'm here, I'll back up a little bit. So imagine that every time I want to make a really good point with you that I want you to agree with, I'll do something with my hands over here on this side. So I'll be like, everyone agrees with this. You know, we have to do this. But then I'll start being like, yeah, but there's people over here that I don't know. Like, I don't really know about them. You can't really trust the people on the other side. And now that I've kind of established to you, like, this is the good side, that's the bad side, I can reinforce that a few times, go off on a tangent, come back from that tangent 5-10 minutes later, talk about something completely else. And now I know every time I talk about, say, Joe Biden, or every time I talk about Donald Trump and Joe Biden's over here, like, I don't have to tell you that Joe Biden's good if I say him and I put my hands on this side, and Donald Trump's bad if I say it over here. I could just be like, oh, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. So that concept of, like, spatial anchoring is a really powerful one that, again, like, some people just inherently do that because they're almost like visually plotting out like a memory palace in front of them.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to hear somebody that knows a lot about that and can pick it out.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
To watch, did you see that Dave Smith debated Chris Cuomo on Patrick Bet-David's show about COVID stuff last Friday night?
Who won?
I mean, obviously, Dave Smith tore him to shreds, but Chris Cuomo is just doing stuff with his hands all the time. Chris Cuomo would say, like, oh, well, I never did that. I never laughed about Joe Rogan taking ivermectin. And then they would, like, show the clip of him and Don Lemon, like, chuckling about Joe Rogan taking horse paste. And then he would just, like, and then they would go back to the debate and you'd just be like, you'd talk about how that didn't happen. How he was talking about something else. And it was, I mean, it takes a special kind of person to be able to lie that way, you know?
I mean, that could be construed as an NLP.
And he was doing shit with his hands the whole time.
So it works on some people at such a subconscious level that you don't know it. But yeah, like if you know about what spatial anchoring is, another really good example, if you have ever done like in-person sales where you had to go and buy like a car or a tractor or whatever from like the dude that makes the commission right there with you.
Yeah.
They'll pull this weird touchy feely crap with you where they'll like touch you on your elbow or like they'll, hey bud, how's it going? Like they'll like make physical contact with you. And they'll usually do that as a physical anchor. So every time they want to like drill in a great deal or like make you feel like supercharged, they might give you one of those little bumps. It's almost like a little boost. And every time they say like, oh, and you know, I'll get you 10 grand off, you know, bump, bump when they say that kind of stuff. And again, they maybe don't know what they're doing. I would assume a lot of them do. Like they actually have gone through sales training and they tell them like touch people if they're kinetic and all this stuff.
Yeah. That's sleazy, man. It feels so gross to me to try to sell anything to anybody.
Like at a certain point, you're either selling something to someone or you're working for somebody. And those are almost like the only two options that you've ever got.
Yeah. Entrepreneurship, I guess, would be a different way to do it too.
And I know you're like now almost like a defunct libertarian, but there was, you got into the nerd politics of the economics and stuff. So you could at least have a few coherent, like, philosophies, I guess, even if you no longer back them. But I'm just curious because one of the things that I always struggled with libertarianism, which I only really agree with in the scope of like everything should be legal, and I know that's like an oversimplification, and I don't mean everything unanimously, but like drugs and you know, loud music and pretty much everything, dangerous fireworks should all be legal.
Yeah, it's the non-aggression principle. It's like, as long as I'm not aggressing against anybody, you know, I'm not, as long as it's a victimless crime, and you know, it falls apart under any scrutiny really fast because that's subjective for one, what aggression is. And then, you know, I think that there's like more ways to like destroy culture and society than to just, you know, physically injure someone.
Well, and a lot of it breaks down for me in like the most technical and boring way possible. But my go-to example, because I haven't come up with that one, is that what if I've got a horse and my horse accidentally, like I don't do it, but my horse kicks the shoemaker's son in the head and he's dead now. And like no one was necessarily at fault, but now the only guy that makes shoes in my whole town doesn't want to sell me shoes anymore because he's got a grudge against me because my horse killed his firstborn kid or whatever.
Yeah. And if you're a libertarian spurg, you'd say, well, that guy needs to be made whole for his son. So they would go to a third party, arbitrator, and he would decide what that little boy's life was worth. And then the guy who owned the horse would have to make him whole. It would be something like that.
It's like exactly what we have now with a lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other answer that I usually will get, which is also not philosophically consistent, which as you've learned doesn't matter all that much when it comes to like converting people or getting in their minds, but that, oh, well then you can make your own shoes or you just find another shoe. And it's like, but that also reveals how a monopoly would kind of start within that society, because now another guy starts making shoes and the first shoemaker hypothetically is like, hey, you know what? You can sell shoes in this town, but we don't sell shoes to Adam because his horse killed my kid. And the other shoemaker's like, no problem. You know, one guy, fine. We can just not sell that guy's shoes. Now you've got
private company, bro.
Yeah, exactly.
Start your own Amazon.
That's the hardest one.
Yeah, like another great one is just like, you know, it's all these libertarian college professors. They're all pedos. They want to argue like the age of consent. I don't know if you ever remember when Thaddeus Russell got in big trouble for that, because he was interviewing this guy from some state university in New York, gay Jewish guy.
Who's Thaddeus Russell? Is he a libertarian?
He was like a leftist anarchist who kind of had a moment. He was kind of like the right wing's, one of the right wing's pet leftists for a little bit, you know, kind of like their James Lindsay for a second. And he had this libertarian professor on his show, and they were like talking about how the age of consent should be like 2. And that it's just, it was so horrible. And you'll really quickly get into those kind of arguments. And then
was this like a debate to show the,
it wasn't even a debate. It was just a guy he had on his podcast.
And I mean, I'm just trying to search for, out of all the millions of things that you could even project out into the world vocally with your voice, like what is the point? If you were to be devil's advocate in this guy, you know, if you were this spur, what would even be the point of arguing for an age of consent of 2? Like who benefits from that?
I mean, pedos.
Just politicians, I guess.
Yeah. So I don't know how we got there, but yeah, that's the kind of thing that'll happen. And what I was going to say is like, say this guy, this really rich guy, Jeff Bezos, he's made $1 billion. It's a anarcho-capitalist society. He's got a big compound, a big piece of property. He hires a private army. And he wants to make the age of consent on his property. Everybody can come live there. He wants to make the age of consent 6 years old. So parents who agree with that can bring their kids, and their kids could consent to sex with adults. And
I mean, now you're just describing the Finders, which is just another, like everything that they're trying to do, the CIA has already done it. Like,
so yeah. So if you're an anarchist who's against that, and you say like, well, I wouldn't allow that. I'd be like, okay, well, what would you do about it? Would you create your own private army and go fight the billionaires' army and declare war on them? That sounds like aggression to me. What if they made a religion around it, and then you were attacking their culture and their religion?
Oh, I guess this is where I'm an absolute ignorant bumpkin when it comes to like the fine details of libertarianism. But I guess I've always assumed that religion is truly separated from libertarianism. Like at no point does your religion give you any extra rights or special privileges within libertarianism. Like there's never a race card. There's never a religion card. this again isn't like the platonic ideal of everything. And I realize that race and religion would probably play some kind of an impact, but like a true, like diehard libertarian seems that all of that would be completely superficial. No.
Yeah. I'm not sure. Maybe. Okay. So we'll say there's no religion around it. What would be the libertarian solution to not wanting a ranch where 6-year-olds get raped?
I honestly don't know. Almost feels like a religious thing, because let's say when we first started talking about this, you mentioned that like abortion being like a one issue thing, like a very serious issue, worse than murder. So now it's like, what if you find out that there's an abortion clinic like within 50 miles of you, and they've just like, you know, 1 billion served or whatever, they've got the big golden arch or whatever, and you just see the numbers just ticking all the time. And if you truly believe that this is like the worst thing that anyone could ever do, like either you just accept and you're like, God, you know, let God judge them, he'll sort them all out, or you've got like the militant ones that are like, I'm gonna become a Knights Templar right now, and I'm gonna go and sort this out on behalf of G-Man. It's the exact same thing when you're talking about these anarcho-capitalists that want to set up like a weird commune that anything goes. It's kind of the same decision, like let them be and hope that something stops them, or they just find out in the end, or rally the troops and go and take them on. If they're a billionaire, that should almost not matter as much, unless now you're setting up for a generational sort of warfare, which again just feels like what we've got now anyways, just with, you know, less steps.
Yeah.
So what do we do? We're just screwed no matter, even if libertarians come into play. It almost just seems that. And
but I don't think, I mean, why are we even talking about them? Because it's a moot point. Like there's no power there.
Well, I guess the point being that right now we've got this like very sophisticated, not in a good way, but like highly sophisticated, overly complex system where all the exact things seem to play out the same way that in like a heavily reduced system where it's just libertarianism and aggregism and like you know, bartering systems. Like if that, some of the promise, I guess, as I always understood from libertarians who try to court me, which deaf ears. But it was almost like, see, it's so much simpler. See, the rules are make so much more sense, and you don't have to have law degrees, and you don't have to navigate the system with some kind of a government, you know, like liaison, because you're just a monster in the eyes of the court. That's part of the promise of it, is that it just goes back to good old fashioned. But it seems that the exact same hypotheticals that play out in that good old fashioned libertarian society, it's just like the simpler version of exactly how it plays out now. It's almost like the religions and the governments and the structures that grow around us are like adapting to us rather than us trying to adapt to them.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And, you know, I don't think like the free market, the ultimate, you know, free market, I don't think shipping every American manufacturing job overseas and destroying the middle class is necessarily a good thing. You know, I think that's harmful to our culture and our society. And so.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like there's any putting that genie back.
Are you trying to argue? What are we even talking about?
Well, it just, you had like a journey, right? That where you went from being completely leftist, which I interpret as being like pro state, give the state all the power, give them more money, let them pass more laws, let them pass more taxes.
I mean, I wasn't even sophisticated enough at that point to consider anything.
Okay, so it was more just like Team Blue versus the nuances of what that entailed.
Right.
So then my assumption is that when you switch to libertarianism, which you subsequently left, but that was a more informed, because you talked about reading Rothbard and trying to debate people and pick out the philosophical inconsistencies with their own stances, which seemed that now you had a more active interest in like all these like political machinations, right? So you went from ignorant Team Blue to feeling like you were well-informed enough to try and convert other people, reading the materials, to now, I guess, leaving that and being a little bit more apathetic about it. And now it's like you'll vote for Orange Man Bad for the sake of like, that's the simple option that we've got. So if you've kind of gone through the full gamut, it's like that weird meme where it's like the bumpkin at the far end of the bell curve. And then you've got like the stressed out nerd that thinks he's like the highly enlightened one at the top of the bell curve. And then back at the exact same position, you've got like the Jedi that's on like the same level as the bumpkin. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, the visual.
I don't have that meme on my timeline, but I can understand it, I think.
So, but the concept being,
I don't think I'm a Jedi. I think I'm more of a bumpkin.
But it's the all things being equal, right? It's right. Almost like you started in ignorance. You develop, like, you read all the things and you're like, okay, I understand the ins and outs. And then you realize, oh, that never mattered. Like, so you kind of like start back where you're at, but you're in a place where you've been through that journey. And I guess that's the point of like all of these weird inconsistencies with libertarianism and the current political structure now, that it almost seems that it takes up a lot of loose energy to debate all these weird nuances about it, when ultimately, like, things seem to work out exactly the same regardless of the system that they're trying to work themselves out in. Does that make sense?
Yes. It all became much less important to me once I got out of the city, I guess. I don't see like the bad on quite the scale that I did before. Most days I'm on a farm with sheep and chickens, and I mean, that's about it. Like, it doesn't—
What do you miss about the city?
I guess I miss convenience sometimes, or variety of things. It'd be nice to not have to drive 35 minutes to go do jiu-jitsu and have more than one choice of where I could do it. But, or like if I forgot milk at the grocery store, to be able to go back and get it. And so I'd have it for my coffee in the morning, but it's just stuff like that. That's it. I have a hard time operating in the city now. It's like a sensory overload. I'm in the city on Sundays. I go to church in right outside of Portland, and then I go help my wife at her work. And it's a culture shock every week.
Can you point out a city folk yet? Like, are you like so far removed that you can tell when a city slicker shows up by mannerisms or like, I don't know.
I mean, I don't live that far. I live close to a town. I live 30 minutes from a town, but I mean, most of the people, I can tell most of the people who live around me because they're like obese and use Rascal scooters at Walmart. But there's a lot of that.
They're not homesteading.
No, there's people that have lived out here generationally, and there's people with cattle and livestock and things like that. But you know, there's some people that have recently moved out here, I guess, but not very many.
If things go to hell, and like, let's say the city just shuts down or whatever, you become isolated in the town that you're at within like a, I don't know, 20-30 mile radius or something, how homestead are you? Like, do you got animals and plants and vegetation and crops and things that could last you indefinitely? Or like, how have you figured out the math on like exactly how long your supplies would last until you'd have to go and venture out, like zombie apocalypse style?
I don't have any vegetables. I don't garden. I have livestock, but the purpose of moving out here wasn't to prep or to get ready for the end. Like, it's just to have a more enjoyable life and not have to be around like bums and piles of human feces.
Fair point. And I didn't mean to imply prepping.
No, I know that,
but like a self-sustaining lifestyle.
And that when I thought that I was going to do that was in my peak libertarian years. I've got stockpiles of ammo and unregistered things out in the shop out there. And I don't think that any of it would do me any good if it all went bad.
I mean, in the short term, maybe like when you're talking about measuring days or weeks, but yeah, in like the ultimate scheme of things,
I got three chest freezers full of beef and pork. I've got a generator. I've got generator switchover power at my house. That's for when it snows out here. It's not for when the grid goes down.
You can just like blink one eye if you don't want it to directly, but like, are there any militias that you've encountered out there? Like little you know, vigilante parties or anything?
When we first moved out here, it was the height of lockdowns. And, you know, I live in Northwest Oregon. It was happening here, you know. Luckily, we got out of the immediate Portland area. And, you didn't have to comply up here where I'm at. I operate in Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington. I live right by the Columbia River. I could take a bridge over to Washington. That's where I go to, like, Home Depot and stuff. And nobody was – I mean, there was a lot of fat MAGA boomers who were wearing – masks over there, but you know, you didn't have to. So when we first moved out here, we were driving home one day and we saw on like a power pole right by our house, like a flyer for like some like United Patriots group that was like meeting in
Crazy Town,
which is right by where I live. I just doxed myself, I guess.
Pre-recorded, but we'll replace that with
okay.
Somewhere nice, Beverly Hills. Got it.
It's cool. Thanks. We're like, well, we don't really know anybody out here. Maybe, you know, I was considering leaving my job at the time. I was like, maybe I could go out there and meet some people that need, you know, just odd jobs done. I could make a little bit of money and meet some people. And we went out there and it was like a full on like Q-tard meeting in like this Baptist church. And they like handed us like a copy of the Constitution when we went in. We had to say the Pledge of Allegiance, and like they were Q people who had just like woken up and were talking about really, really dumb stuff. And we stayed for about 20 minutes and then left.
So, were you ever in the Q movement? Did you ever get
no, I wasn't. You know, like I remember hearing about it when it first started, and I tried to
how go did you on- dodge that? Because you were like right in the thick of like the prime real estate for that.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out how to work 4chan.
I don't believe that. You just go to 4chan.org/poll. Done.
That's yeah, I went on 4chan. I'd never been on. I don't play video games, so I'd never been on like a message board site like that.
Okay.
And it didn't really make sense to me what was going on. So I never went back. I would listen to people talk about it and stuff like that. And maybe thought that there was some validity to it for, you know, the first couple months that I knew about it. But then after a while, you know, I was in peak libertarian mode at that point, was like pretty against Donald Trump as well. Another group I did, when we lived closer to Portland, I got into the Freedom Cell movement, which was kind of like a libertarian, anarchist, agorist like group of people who were meeting up around the pandemic and like bragging to each other about how they didn't wear masks and how they wanted to like move out of the city and get land. So I would go to those meetups like monthly. And it was, you know, that's kind of what started like souring me away from that movement, was meeting actual anarcho-capitalists in the real world. Like, and like we went to some freedom festivals and stuff, and I've told this story before, but like I'm an old punk rocker, and when I show up to a freedom festival, it's like, oh, I thought we were going to be like trying to end the Fed, but it looks like a fish parking lot here, a parking lot at a fish concert. And like, there's just hippies, white people with dreadlocks spinning around in circles, doing like massive amounts of drugs and just like doing nothing. So, yeah, I mean, that's where it all started kind of going downhill for me.
I mean, I think that both of us were almost like target demo for that kind of thing. It didn't pick up for me because I almost feel like I had earned my conspiracy stripes, because the same way that a lot of people that went hard into Q, like the Facebook group style Qs, it was that same dynamic that you were describing before about the kid that finds the shiny toy and like he just wants to like show it off to everyone and talk about it to everyone indefinitely.
So you're saying you were a little bit further down the road than somebody's aunt who had just found out about maybe that there might be some high level pedophilia or something like that.
I listened to Alex Jones back before he, like, you know, back in like the late 90s or the early 2000s, at least. And, I read like one of my claims to fame now, I guess I'm still not proud of it, cause it definitely screwed up my path in life. It reduced my number of options, but in the military in 2003, I got restationed to go to Afghanistan. And part of that was that I had to get an anthrax vaccine along with a whole bunch of other ones. Note what time I just said the V word for the YouTube edition. But I remember at that point, man, and I went back home and I just went onto the internet and I was like, what's in the AV thing?
Did you feel anything when it went into you?
Well, the long story short is I didn't get it, but I didn't get it to the point of getting an LOR and an LOC and Article 15 and eventually a bad conduct discharge for not following orders, along with a litany of other things. I wasn't a perfect person, but that ended up being the catalyst. And this is 2003. And I remember when the avian bird flu made a big resurgence in like 05 or 06. Then a couple years after that, there was like the swine flu thing. And everyone I knew, literally everyone I knew on all sides were all about, let's go get the Tamiflu. Let's go stock up. Let's go and get all the shots and everything. And I just, at a certain point, maybe just as being like out of the spite, but it's like, if I got kicked out of the military for rejecting this V, like I'm just going to reject every V. Not a special one that like, oh, that one I'll take. So when the 2019, 2020 thing came around and all these people are like waking up and it was just like, bro, like talk to me 17 years ago. Like I have been on this boat since before you even knew there was a boat in the water.
The James Franco meme first time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the same thing too with all the QAnon stuff where they were like, did you know that top level officials are actually like kidnapping children? I was like, yeah, because I literally read the Franklin scandal by John DeCamp in like the early 2000s while I was in the military.
Franklin cover up.
Yeah. Franklin scandal is the Nick Bryant version of that. But so, I mean, yeah, when all the Q stuff came out, every single thing that was like the big newsbreaker, I was like the hipster James Franco every time.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, that's cute. No, you just found out about that. No, that's cool.
Yeah. Tell me about it. That guy, the most recent self-immolation guy. Did you see like his manifesto?
I did. I know I've
dude, he read was like, talking about like kindergarten stuff. He was talking about like the Federal Reserve and stuff like that. That's what it was just like 101, like, yeah, Alex Jones, 1999 stuff, but a leftist version. And he'd like found out about some stuff and then lit himself on fire.
I mean, it's a sick litmus test or a metric to go by, but I just wonder with that guy's constitution, what point in my life I would have self-immolated if I had that same approach to reality, right? Like, would it have been in 03? Would it have been in like 2001 when I realized I was in the military fighting, helping gear up for a war that was based on like a self-inflicted wound, you know, like a false flag? Like, I don't know. At what point do you just set yourself on fire? And also, you know, no offense to that dude, but it kind of didn't work. Like, I am the target demo for whatever he was trying to convey. And I guess all I knew about him was that he set himself on fire like a weirdo. And I didn't know anything about his manifesto.
Yeah. Until I just brought his name, his memory up. Nobody had thought about him for the past month. So
right. I didn't know. Work, I mean, bro. You assume that he's got a manifesto, but it's like, you know,
it was Reddit tier stuff. Like,
well, and funny enough, because I was technically capable of getting onto 4chan and all this stuff. So like it bypassed me just because I felt like they were just regurgitating things that I had already sort of integrated into my entire weird mindset. But one of the biggest ones, and this is where I saw like a weird QAnon Trump sort of like converging in a way. And it was for me personally, because in Orlando they had the Pulse nightclub shooting, and it's right. Literally like you could probably hear it if someone shot a gun at that intersection right now. I could hear it. It's like very.
I'm happy you decided to stay in that night.
It was the one night we had an orgy here at the house. Yeah, we didn't have to go and pick up the twinks. So, yeah. But like that particular event, as it's happening in real time, there was Reddit threads on like news and on like all these, you know, the big Reddits. And then I'm like seeing in real time them all just disappearing. And it's like, what the hell is going on? Like, I want to know what's happening a couple miles away. The news doesn't have it because the news is like a freaking day behind now at this point. And Reddit and Twitter and 4chan, And basically Reddit was like the most up to date. So long story short, I eventually found the only subreddit that was still covering it in real time was this thing called the Donalds. And I had no idea that it was about Donald Trump. I mean, obviously I did within like a few minutes of going on there, but for whatever reason, the Donald subreddit was the only place on the internet that had like up to date information on the Pulse nightclub shooting. And I was like, that's weird. I subscribed to it. And all of a sudden I'm getting these like QAnon. I didn't know what QAnon was at that point, but I'm getting these like memes now on my feed because I'm part of this group that was the only place to get the nightclub shooting. And the same thing happened. I don't know, like I don't know how long it was after that, but it was like 6 months or a year. There was the France shooting and like their thing where the guys had the
Eagles of Death Metal one.
Exactly. Yeah. The death metal one. Exact, like literally the exact same thing happened. It's in world news. It's in news. Now it's gone. All the threads, they're all gone. You know where it's at? It's in the Donald. This is the same thing happened. There was like a Selena Gomez concert where somebody got shot in that one. Same thing. So at a certain point, like now I started looking at the Donald subreddit as like the only place that I could go for reliable news when things were too spicy for mainstream media. And I don't know if it was like QAnon had co-opted it already, or if they also saw that dynamic of like, oh wow, people are going to this one place. They've got a monopoly on like real things happening in real time. Let's go ahead and co-opt that and start injecting QAnon. Like I still have no idea where it started and where it ended, where like the QAnon and the Donald and like covering this, this, you know, sort of taboo news coverage all conflated, but they all like turn into like a perfect sphere. And that's what swallowed a lot of people up and got them into conspiracies and into Donald Trump and into like the whole QAnon rabbit hole.
Yeah. That was a fun time. Did that shooting happen during Donald Trump's presidency?
I honestly don't. You mean the Pulse? I don't think so.
Okay. So there was already a Donald subreddit before his presidency.
Let's see. Pulse nightclub shooting was in June 12th, 2016.
I think he would have.
And he was in June.
yeah, he so would have been. He would have been in like January of 2016.
So yeah, I guess. Of course. I mean, that wouldn't have happened in an Obama administration or a Hillary Clinton administration. That never would have happened.
Right.
No. You know what though? It was around elections because I distinctly remember them campaigning, and then the father of the guy
there was something weird there.
Shooting was like in Hillary Clinton campaigns and stuff, like on TV,
The background, just standing there.
Dude, that is such a deep, like that one never really got the deep dive that it deserved. I don't know if I'm the one to do it, but
yeah.
Like that, dude, what a weird freaking story. And the guy's wife was like either cast as being completely absent-minded, like to the point where it probably was illegal for her to even get married to like an adult because she had like the thought process of, I don't know, like a 9-year-old or something, or at least that's how they portrayed her on the news. The dad shows up, like all this stuff was really sketch about the entire operation.
Yeah. Very, very weird.
So where are you at on conspiracy theories now? Do you even care anymore? Or is that all like superficial, material, earthly stuff?
It definitely is, but it's a lot of fun still for me. I'm a program to kill guy. It's about all I really care about these days. Just reading that book and then being able to look at all this other different parapolitical stuff through that lens. I'm not really getting into any weird woo-woo stuff. I just like looking at like Pat Conn and you know, different serial killers and things like that. And once you read Program to Kill, it makes it really enjoyable because you can go out and, I don't know if enjoyable is the right word, but I do enjoy it. You can go out and kind of consume normie podcasts and media and documentaries and Netflix series and interpret it through the lens of Program to Kill, the genius 2004 novel by Dave, or not novel, nonfiction book by Dave McGowan.
So you're kind of in the heartland for like Bigfoot sightings. Is that considered woo-woo? Like, where are you at on Bigfoot?
I'm open to Bigfoot. I hear weird stuff out here all the time. And definitely, you know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. My grandma's from, you know, Washington State. And I was raised with stories of her encounters. And yeah, like when I used to have to be at work at, you know, 6:30 in the morning in Portland, I'd leave here at 4:30. And I'd hear weird whoops and knocking and things like that. So definitely open to Bigfoot, cryptids. I like all that stuff, but it's not something that's really captured my heart and held on to it as much these days.
All right, well, we'll start to wrap this up, and I've got a final little segment that I think will be fun to ask you now, since your thoughts and feelings might have changed since we first started talking a while ago. So let me just play the intro, and we'll get into it.
Hey, conspiracy buffs, I double dare you to take some PCP, the Paranormal Conspiracy Probe. On your marks, get set, and go!
All right, the goal is just to get a temperature check from you on how much you believe certain conspiracies.
I don't like that description.
What, the PCP, Paranormal Conspiracy Probe?
Temperature check.
Okay, well, we're gonna give you a litmus test. Does that feel any better?
Yeah, I guess I took my dogs to the veterinarian today, so it's fresh in my mind.
Well, if it helps, it is going to be an anal thermometer.
Okay, cool. As long as it's, you know, explained to me beforehand.
So just on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 meaning you don't believe it all, 10 meaning you do believe it. So if we said Bigfoot, 1 to 10, how much do you believe that Bigfoot is legitimate, real phenomenon?
6.
Okay. How about flat Earth?
8.
What about dinosaurs?
0.
What about fire-breathing, flying dragons?
4.
What about little gray aliens?
0.
David Icke reptilians?
0.
A class of giants that lives inside of Hollow Earth.
If you take David Icke out of that, I say 7.
Oh, really? So, well, yeah. What's the delineation between a David Icke reptilian and just a non-David Icke reptilian?
One's Gnostic and one isn't.
Which is the Gnostic one?
The David Icke one.
Real? Okay. I want to get into that a little bit. 1 to 10 that I could order a book off of Amazon that tells me how to summon a demon, and I could summon a demon in my room with that book.
I think the Necronomicon is available on Amazon. 10.
So let's say I did that and I read the Necronomicon and I actually tried to summon Azazel.
Okay.
What do you think is the likelihood that someone could actually summon a legitimate demon from a freshly printed book? On the point here being that, like, you didn't have to go and find some ancient grimoire that's got blood soaked and you had to get an Eye of a Newt. Like, I just buy something prime. It shows up on my doorstep. I open it up. It's freshly printed. No one's ever seen it before. I read it and I try and summon a demon based on what it told me within the confines of my desk here. How likely is it that I could actually summon a demon through that?
7.
What about angels? Do you think you can summon angels?
I don't. I think 5.
How much do you think you could recognize an angel for what it is on 1 to 10? Like, if one just showed up to you spontaneously, would you know it's an angel?
I don't think we have the discernment to.
What about Dogman? You know about Dogman?
Yeah, I've done plenty of podcasts on Dogman. I'll give it a 3.
What about chupacabras?
I've been to Puerto Rico. No evidence. 2.
So I already know that you gave Flat Earth like a 7 or an 8. So this... Mm-hmm. In the context of being open to flat Earth, that a human being has stepped foot on the moon in the last 100 years.
And 0 is still, is it 1 the lowest or 0 the lowest?
Whatever. Yeah. 1 or 0.
Interchangeable. 0. That's my litmus test for people.
So I just wanted to point out that I have had someone that said they believed in flat Earth, but also believe we stepped foot on the moon, and they explained it. And I think it was my friend Maverick Approach, but he explained it that if the moon is local, it's actually a better chance that we could step foot on the moon than if it were in like the real model and the globe model, where it's like, you know, all the way out in space, like hundreds of thousands of miles away. That if it's local, that you could potentially visit it, or it would make more sense that you could visit it. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting.
So is he claiming that that the moon is within
the firmament? It's within the dome or the firmament.
It's and not. It's not so on the on the outside of the Tim Allen radiation belts.
Right. I don't know. I thought that was an interesting one.
Yeah.
And then yeah, and.
I had Bart Sabrell on my show twice, and he just went on Joe Rogan, so that's pretty cool.
What was his belief in that?
Bart Sabrell's the guy that got punched in the face by Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Read Moon Man, great book. Eight hour listen if you want to listen to it on Audible. Good book.
And then final one, 0 to 10, that Freemasons are currently running the world.
Of 3.
What if this were 200 years ago? Would it still be a 3?
Yeah, I think there's probably some influence, but not omnipotent.
You passed the test. You passed the litmus test. We're not going to kick you out yet. And I know that you said the Deborah Gets Red Pilled podcast is basically like you've put a period at the end of that sentence. Is there any other projects that I can link to or anything else that you want to get out there? So someone wants to convert to orthodoxy. Are you open for evangelism on demand?
I'm interested. I'm open to telling people about my experiences. I'm not interested in debating or talking theology with anybody because I'm not equipped to do it.
You have a new podcast or anything coming out or?
I am definitely open to doing something in the future. I'm really enjoying the freedom of not having something hanging over my head a couple times a week anymore. If I did anything in the future, it would be all just purely parapolitical, and I would be much more anonymous this time around. So if anybody out there is looking for something like that, I would love to do something with someone who I don't have to bring along for the ride as much anymore. It was very, very stressful for me to have to conduct an interview, do research, and then kind of like hold Deborah's hand through it too. And I was putting more pressure on myself than I probably needed to, but that's kind of like what burnt me out in the long run.
Who do you think Deborah is voting for in the upcoming election?
I think it'd probably, you know, just be the Democrat, whoever they wheel out that's not RFK.
If Biden makes it.
I could probably convince her to vote for RFK. She would never vote for Trump. And yeah, I think
what would it take? What's her ultimate sticking point with Trump?
Dude, I asked her some crazy stuff like if somebody, you know, if Joe Biden was convicted of pedophilia, would you vote for him or Trump? And it was still him.
Well, as it should be. I mean, you don't want the orange man bad in office. Are you kidding?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so great lady.
Would you consider it a success or a failure, or is it not in those confines?
I mean, it was successful to a certain extent, but not to the point where I created some like philosophically perfect deep thinker who was able to retain enough knowledge to progress at the level that I wanted to.
And it's so did in a strained analogy here, but did Deborah like spit the red pill back up, or did she like fully integrate it and then pull like what's the guy's name, Cyrus from the Matrix, where he's like
Cyrus the virus,
not real, but I want the steak, ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, I'd say that much. I think she knows that there's funny business all around. Like I said, I don't think she has the ability to retain enough knowledge from everything I hose blasted her with to like, you know, be able to recall anything. But, you know, I think I got her off CNN and for a little bit, I guarantee you she's still back on there. And I can't blame her because I still have my warm, fuzzy version of CNN that I listen to, you know, to get my confirmation bias and stuff like that. But
what is that? What's your warm, fuzzy version of CNN?
I mean, I still listen to Dave Smith.
Everyone needs a blanket.
Yeah,
it's not bad to have a comfort blanket.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad I got to do the show. It was a definite. It was 2 or 3 years of my life, you know, of one of the main things of my life, and we had some incredible shows, and we had some really, really bad ones that I wasn't happy with. I wasn't overall wasn't happy with the quality of the show a lot of the time, but we had some stuff that, you know, I've gotten some messages from people who said, you know, your show wasn't like the in-depth, hard-hitting, you know, conspiracy show that I listened to for other people or parapolitics or stuff like that. But it was just really nice to be able to like read between the lines. And I think we gave people an outlet who weren't able to talk to their families during the, you know, the past 4 years about all the craziness going on. And I think that was cathartic for some people. So I'm really happy that I was able to do that.
100%, man. Honestly, that was my favorite part of the whole premise, is that like Deborah's not my mother-in-law, but she definitely acted as like a proxy for that person that's in my family. So hearing you and hearing her responses to stuff, it was cathartic. It was like, I'm never going to bring this up to that aunt at Thanksgiving. Yeah. But like, I loved that someone was doing it and I could almost like live through that experience. Anyways, one of my favorite podcasts of all time. I highly recommend that people go back and listen to the episodes while they're still up there. I thought, and it's a fascinating journey too, because when you started, there was like the transition of like, you went and bought new property, you moved out, you were like, you know, constantly doing construction, running into all the snags. Like I felt like I also got to vicariously live through you doing the homestead thing, and I can just keep being like a shitty city slicker. Because I've already got the experience through you. I appreciate that.
I'm glad I could provide that for you, Thomas. Thank you so much for having me on, man. I'm going to continue supporting you any way that I can. And yeah, just thanks for everything you've done. And thanks for being on my show way back in the day, man. It was so cool. We did, maybe I'll re-release it. For some reason, only like the last 100 shows are coming up on the, if you look my show up, I did
see that. Yeah. It starts at like exactly 100 and that's it.
I'll try to talk to my podcast carrier and see if I can get them re-released. But I had some Son of Sam stuff I want to re-release. That'd be cool to redo yours. I think I had you on twice. I think the first time you came on with my friend Dean and we talked about Colonia Dignidad and MK Ultra. It was like, it might've been one of the longest podcasts I did. And I remember like my computer crashed during it. And like, I couldn't figure out, it was before I had done any editing or anything like that. I didn't have intro music or anything on the show at that time. And so like there's like 45 minutes of dead air at the end of the podcast. And luckily it downloaded and saved, because it was like one of those ones where like, this is an insane conversation. And if I lose it, I was like gutted, man. So maybe I'll start putting some out again, just to.
And that was before I even knew what to self censor. So that one was probably went right off the rails immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, man, I'm really glad that we're friends and we're in contact, and I'd love to help you out any way I can. So let me know.
Awesome, man. Thanks again for coming by. Lifelong friends, man. I appreciate you. You're one of the coolest people that I know. So thanks for just being you, brother.
Right on. Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
All right, I'll meet you at the docks at Wednesday after 8.
Okay, cool. That's a pulse.
Ready for a cosmic conspiracy about Stanley Kubrick, moon landings, and the CIA? Go visit NASAComic.com.
NASAComic.com, CIA's biggest con. Stanley Kubrick put us on, that's why we're singing this song. I'm NASAComic.com, go visit NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Yeah, go visit NASAComic.com. Oh, NASAComic.com, CIA's biggest con. Stanley Kubrick put us on, that's why we're singing this song about NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Go visit NASAComic.com. Yeah, go visit NASAComic.com.
Never a Straight Answer is a 40-page comic about Stanley Kubrick directing the Apollo space missions.
Yeah, go visit NASAComic.com.
This is the perfect read for comic, Kubrick, or conspiracy fans of all ages. For more details, visit nasacomic.com.
Paranoid. Scribble my life away, driven to write the page. Will it enlighten your brain? Give you the flight, my plane. Paper, the highs ablaze. Somewhat of an amazing feel when it's real to real. You will engage it. Your favorite, of course, the lord of an arrangement. I gave you the proper results to hit the pavement. If they get emotional, hey, maybe your language, a game. How they playing it well without Lakers. Evade them, whatever the cost, they are the shapeshift. Snakes get decapitated, met is the apex. Execution of flame, you are. Nuclear bomb distributed at war, rather gruesome for eyes to see. Max them out, then I light my trees. Blow it off in the face. You're despising me for what though? Calculated and rather cutthroat. Paranoid American must be all the blood smoke for real. Lord, give me a day away, vacate. They wait around to hate whatever they say. Man, it's not in the least bit. We get heavy rotate when the beat hits. So thank us, you're welcome. Fuck the niggas for real. You're welcome. They ain't never had a deal. You're welcome, man, they lacking appeal. You're welcome, yet they doing it still. You're welcome.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.